Well, Joel Smith is here today. Joel, are you able to unmute?
I am. I'm unmuted.
Awesome. Joel, I have a question for you. Did you need to share your screen or anything with us today, or are you good to go?
I'm good to go. Yes, I talked to Jeff about this, and we'll just talk without slides.
Beautiful. And so Joel Smith is here to talk to us about this great study that's been going on at USC since about 2008. And so, Joel, go ahead and take it away.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for inviting me to speak today. I was hoping to be joined by Dr. Mark Humayun, whose work I'm kind of representing today. But unfortunately, he had a timing issue and wasn't able to make it to join us, but wishes he could be here. So thank you for the opportunity. So, as you kind of mentioned, my name's Joel Smith. I'm the Senior Associate Vice President for Health Science Advancement. Essentially, that means fundraising in support of Mark's work. And as you may have picked up, I'm not originally from here. So my accent, I usually get the question, am I English or Australian after I start speaking? And in case you're thinking either of those two, you are right, because I'm originally from the UK, but I did live in Australia for 16 years before coming to USC. So in case you were thinking, where is he from? That's where I'm from. And I've been at USC now for 2 years. And I really was excited to come to USC, to come to the US, to come to California, for the opportunity to work with world-leading researchers and people who are in a position to make profound changes to health. And at USC, we have a number of those. But I have to say, I think the most exciting work that is going on is with Mark Humayun, and his mission to cure blindness. And that's what I'm here today to talk more about, specifically his work with AMD. So before I get into that, though, I did want to give you a little bit of background about Mark himself. And so Mark Humayun is the professor of ophthalmology at USC, and he's the Cornelius J. Pings Chair in Biomedical Sciences. He's also a director at the Ginsberg Institute of Biomedical Therapeutics and a co-director at the Roeske Eye Institute. So he's someone who works across a lot of different areas. He's a clinician. He is a researcher and he's an inventor. And on top of that, his interest really in blindness developed when his grandmother went blind while he was in medical school. And from that point onwards, he really dedicated his career towards working on understanding the eye and understanding blindness and developing cures. So he is an internationally recognized pioneer in vision restoration. And he assembled a team of multidisciplinary experts to help develop the first FDA-approved artificial retina, the Argus II for sight restoration. But more recently, he's been working on this the groundbreaking stem cell retina implant, which is in clinical trials. He has got over 150 issued patents and 315 peer-reviewed publications. So he's a leading expert in his field, it's fair to say. He's also a member of the US Academies of Medicine, Engineering, and Inventors, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and a American Society of Retinal Specialists. He has received numerous awards for his extraordinary contributions. And he was awarded the United States' highest technological achievement, the 2015 National Medal for Technology and Innovation by President Obama. He's also received the 2018 IEEE Biomedical Engineering Award. And if, as if that wasn't enough, he's also been named in the top 1% of ophthalmologists in the US. So that's a little bit about Mark. Hope that gives you a kind of a sense of his areas of focus. And what's unusual for a researcher is to be quite diverse in bringing different disciplines together, which is something that he has really excelled at, and using that particularly for the eye. So his area of focus has been on advanced dry AMD, which, as I'm sure everyone knows, is one of the leading causes of blindness. And unfortunately, over 1 million Americans have dry AMD and are losing their vision because of it. So there is no current cure for it. And globally, 200 million people around the world have dry AMD. And the experience is that the central part of the of vision is lost first as the retina starts to deteriorate over time, and that spreads. So he has been really working to come to terms to understand the disease more and more, and to be able to come up with ways of being able to treat it. So currently approved drugs require frequent injections, but they do not stop or reverse vision loss. And those injections can be as often as monthly. So Mark really asked himself and his team the question, well, what if we can restore sight to people with age-related macular degeneration, one of the world's most common eye disorders? And he realized that they'd have to take a new approach. So before Mark came to USC, he was actually at Johns Hopkins, and he spent many years there working on transplantation, taking others' retina cells and being able to surgically implant them to help repair the damage from AMD. But unfortunately, the results were not good. The transplants didn't work. So when he came to USC, he found himself with a new opportunity, which is USC has a stem cell center. And he was able to team up with the regenerative medicine experts there to try and develop a new approach. So, as I'm sure many of you know, stem cells can be grown from kind of a base cell into various different types of cell, from heart to kidney. And of course, Mark's goal was really to do that for the eye. And I should point out at this stage that we were incredibly fortunate that in California, we have the California Institute of Regenerative Medicine. And we really couldn't have done it without the support they gave us from the inception of this idea all the way through. They've been a vital funding partner. And we're very fortunate to have that in the state of California. And I think, as you mentioned at the beginning, this work has not just begun. It started back in 2008. So over 16 years ago, this approach to be able to regenerate the retina through stem cell work has been developing. I would say slowly, but it's actually been quite quick compared to how research can work. And the area of real focus in terms of the regeneration has been retinal pigment epithelium cells. So those are the cells that are really functional to the support of the retina. And unfortunately, for patients with dry AMD, those are the cells that degenerate over time. Those are also the cells that help regulate the overlying kind of photoreceptor cells. So there's a membrane around the eye. There's the cells that then connect between that membrane and the photoreceptors. And unfortunately, as those retinal pigment epithelium cells start to deteriorate, the regulation of the photoreceptors also deteriorates. So Mark's idea was to be able to replace those, to regenerate those, regrow those, to help the photoreceptors continue to work and the retina continue to function. But of course, there are lots of challenges in doing that. And cell-based therapies face numerous challenges. So you've got the potential, once you're able to develop a cell like this, that the cells don't survive. They may look really good and be kind of replicas of the cells you want, but they might not actually work once they're inside the body. You also have the threat that the immune system will reject them, will see them as foreign, and won't accept them. And you have to make sure that they actually integrate with the pathological tissue around it, which is a challenge in itself. So one of the ways of working around this, one of the solutions that Mark developed, was to create a specialized membrane or platform, something that would pathologically fit with the tissue, but that the stem cells could fit in. Something that he could transport them on into the retina for them to survive and to grow and to integrate. So he had to spend quite some time working on how to do that and how to establish that membrane. But essentially, by working with the experts in stem cell, he was able to bioengineer these cells through the stem cell process, and to be able to implant them on a platform. So once he'd done that, the remaining challenge was, how is he going to get them from the lab and actually into the retina? So he had to develop a method of delivery. And the way that he has come up with that, it was important for him, I should add, that the method of delivery was something that could be replicated. So to be able to develop this and make sure that the impact is widespread, he wanted to make sure it was something that surgeons across the country and potentially across the world could utilize and could use. So he developed a technique which can be replicated, and essentially it uses a tiny needle about the size of a human hair. That needle is then able to enter through the front of the eye, continue inside the eyeball, make precise incisions at the back of the eye, particularly the retina, and lift that up and insert the platform, the implant with the stem cells onto it in the precise location that it's needed for those stem cells to integrate and to grow and to start to regulate the retina again. Amazingly, this process is actually pretty straightforward. It can take around 2 hours and allows the stem cells to be positioned securely to start to take hold, to grow, and to start regenerating those damaged epithelium cells and help to make retina functional again. So, as you can see, he had a number of challenges that he was able to come across, but there were really key four innovations in the work that he did to get to this point. So one was to be able to actually mass produce these functional epithelium cells, which hadn't been developed before. He didn't want it to be something that was so cost prohibitive that you couldn't really roll it out to all the people who needed it. So he needed to be able to produce at scale. Again, fortunately at USC, because of the work that we do in stem cell, we have a dedicated facility to be able to mass produce cells like this. And he's been able to do that work where the quality of the stem cell remains very high. Second was to be able to attach those cells to the specialized platform or membrane that I mentioned. That was a huge challenge that he was able to overcome. And then, again, significantly in terms of being able to deliver this across the country, how to be able to preserve these cells, so actually freeze them, cryopreserve them, and to be able to ship them to different locations across the country where people are really in need of them. So he's been able to develop that process of manufacturing at a level where it can be frozen and cryopreserved to be sent across the country. And then lastly was the treatment of patients in a simplistic way. So an outpatient procedure is all that's required. You don't need to stay overnight to have this procedure. It would be something that would be done relatively quickly, again, making it more accessible for people to be able to benefit from. So those were some really big challenges and innovations that he really developed. And the solutions that he came up with and his team came up with have meant that we end up with something with a therapeutic that has been proven to be effective, easy, and sustainable. So in the clinical trials that we've had so far, and we're about halfway through this clinical trial process, the first stage is really around making sure that the process is safe, that the therapeutic is safe, and that the whole procedure is safe. So that has proved to be effective, but we've also seen that some of the recipients, and at this stage, the recipients were all registered blind, were able to regain vision of up to 3 lines of sight on a vision eye chart. So significant improvement in vision. Now, that wasn't all of them, but it was still a significant improvement for some of them in terms of the vision they were able to gain through this therapeutic. It was also easy, or at least easier than a lot of other procedures to do this, to do something so significant, and it's effectively day surgery. Now, this trial has been going on for just over 3 years, so the clinical data that we've gathered also shows that this procedure, and this therapy is sustainable. So we're seeing that the stem cells are not moving about, they're not being isolated, they're not being rejected by the body. You don't have to take immunosuppressants or any other drugs with this therapy, and it is a one-time procedure. There hasn't been a need in any of the recipients to have another procedure after this. Now we're only at just over 3 years into it, but we don't see any reason why that will change either. So the impact really has been very positive at this, again, at this stage of the clinical trials. And the position of the implants have not moved. There's been no evidence of implant degeneration or that the stem cells are degenerating, which was one of the fears that that might be the case, but that has not happened. So again, we're very happy with the progress that has been made at this point. The other thing that Mark is very focused on is making sure that this is something that is scalable and is accessible to all those who need it. And in terms of the numbers around that, it can be scaled up. So there are sufficient retinal surgeons in the US to be able to demand to cover the demand for this implant. We know that there are 3,800 retinal surgeons in the US, and they perform around 3 to 4 surgeries a week. So if only 1,000, almost a quarter, of those retinal surgeons performed 100 surgeries a year, that would be over 100,000 implant procedures that could be accomplished in a year to help people regain their sight. And the other positive is that there was a recent survey by the New American Society of Retinal Surgeons. And out of all the different therapies that they see as the most promising, cell-based therapy to replace retinal pigmentation epithelium cells is the number one, both in the US and internationally, actually. So the surgeons are really looking for this therapy to come online and to be available. And we're really excited about the potential of that happening, obviously. So to get to this point, many steps have been taken. And I would say going back to 2008, 2009, that was when really the planning for this began. Between 2010 and 2014, all the work that Mark did to be able to grow these stem cells took hold, and the platform to be able to do this work, to be able to implant them. And then if we kind of go up to 2016 and 19, that's when the first phase of the clinical trials really started. And we are now at a point in 2024 where we want to start the second phase of clinical trials. And we have been in a very fortunate position that we've been able to raise most of the money for this. It's about $25 million to run this trial, and we've raised 20. So we are speaking to other donors about getting enough funds to finish the second phase trial. Essentially, that is a clinical trial with 24 subjects. We have a wider selection of a patient population here, so not just people who are registered clinically blind. So we can see the effects across a slightly different patient population. We also want to be able to demonstrate the success of this in multiple clinical sites so that it actually does work if you use it with a surgeon in California or one in Oregon or some other state for that matter. So being able to test that out, making sure that it can be effectively administered and implanted in various different sites. We also then will use that data to prepare the have the results prepared for FDA approval for the final phase, as if you didn't think there are enough phases with clinical trials, to be able to get approval for commercialization of the product. There is also the use of data to be able to actually come up with a personalized treatment, to be able to assess the stage of the disease within different individuals and to decide if there are different dosages or different ways of being able to administer the therapy. So this will provide us a lot more detail in this second trial as to how to have optimum outcomes from the use of the implant and the stem cells that we're creating. And then I've talked quite a bit about Mark's real vision to make sure that this is accessible as much as possible. So he's going to be also working in this phase on developing the manufacturing, distribution, and transportation plan of this therapy, ultimately with the goal of reducing the implant's cost so that it's somewhere between 2,500 and 3,500, trying to make it as affordable a treatment option as possible, which when we look at other drugs and other therapies, is really important. He does not want to create something that is then priced out of the market for people actually benefiting from that therapy. So we are in this phase 2B time slot at the moment, and excited to be able to begin that phase. Once we have completed that, we will then move into the third phase. And we're currently looking at, well, the phase 2B trial will be from this year to probably about 2026 or 2027. And that would be followed by the phase 3 trial, which would be somewhere along the lines of 3 years from there. And at that point, we would hope to get to commercialization and see the benefits of this new therapeutic for people, particularly, I think, first and foremost in the US, but then everywhere across the world, to improve what can be done with dry AMD. So I have talked a lot. I don't know at this point if there are any questions. I'm sure I've probably missed some information that might be helpful for people. But if you have any questions, please let me know.
I'm sure we have a ton of questions, Joel, and it's just really fascinating. And thank you for sharing the story of why this study was so important to him because of his grandmother. I think that's really meaningful, and I think that it really points to how you never know what you're able to do in life. And what kind of impact you can make on folks' lives. So yeah, let's go ahead and open it up for questions. Desi, do we have any hands?
At this point, we do not.
Ah, how about
Oh,
anybody else
wait.
that
One just came.
you said the magic words?
I did. Area code 650.
It's just me, Roger. Okay. I had a very brief thing that applied to something that happened a couple of minutes ago, but I thought you might find it interesting. In 1974, visited the Shasta Roadhouse of Dr. Tenbrook. At that point, Dr. Tenbrook had been dead for 6 years. He died in 1968 of colon cancer. And this is just observant of how time goes and so on. I was using the bathroom off the kitchen, and there were some strange pipes and valves on the toilet, and I wasn't quite sure what that was. And Hazel, Dr. Tenbrook's wife, said, "Oh, don't worry about those. It's just a setup that Alan Jenkins put there to help Dr. Tenbrook irrigate his colostomy." And I just thought that was
Wow.
interesting.
Yes, I don't know a lot of details about colon cancer, but that sounds like a very sophisticated setup.
Oh, well, and again, people can have impacts on people's lives, that's for sure, in all kinds of interesting ways. Thank you, Roger, for sharing that, all
Thanks,
of
Roger.
the
I had
history.
known Alan Jenkins, and I of course knew Dr. Tenbrook, and it just struck me. I don't know how to put it exactly, but
You're like, let's.
and of course had to do with Alan Jenkins' skills at doing practical things, in addition to all of his the category of the things that other people said about him.
We're definitely seeing the combination of engineering and medicine play a bigger and bigger role. So, sounds like he was ahead of the game.
Definitely. Thank you, Roger.
All
Desi, do we
right,
have any other hands?
Frank is next.
Ah, Frank.
Hi there.
Hi,
This
Frank.
is a very, very interesting presentation, and it raises the question for me is that very often we hear about these cool clinical trials that happen, but how does an individual find out about clinical trials and how to sign up for them? Is there like a website for clinical trials where that a person can watch to see what's going on and what they might be able to get signed up for?
That's a great question. So typically the clinical trials have quite strict criteria in terms of who is invited to join, because there are criteria that's set either by the FDA or by the people who are working on it in terms of what they're looking to achieve. Obviously there's some safety constraints too in terms of the health of the participants and making sure that they're in the best position to take part in the clinical trial. And usually there are sites that are known to the researchers that they work with on a regular basis to be able to connect with the clinicians there and assess the patients that are there, to be able to work out whether they're the best people to be in the clinical trial. So it usually does depend on the kind of the network that the researchers have or are using. Sometimes there are as you say, website requests or emails that go out to ask people to be in clinical trials. I've certainly seen some of those, but generally they can be, particularly in a trial like this, quite controlled and very specific about the people that are joining. And they're usually taking up networks of people that they already have connections with.
That was my question too. Frank stole it. Desi, do we have anybody else?
We do not.
Anybody on our panel side have a question? Because I can ask another one.
No one on the panel's side is raising their hand, so.
All right. So I will go ahead and I'll ask another question. So in the beginning, when this was all, you know, coming together, was it always just tested on humans?
That's another great question. No. So in the earlier stages, animal trials are used, again, really for safety, to make sure that there's not going to be a really adverse reaction to the cells that are being manufactured and how they are, particularly, I guess, the method of being able to get them into the right place in the eye as well. So no, they are. It doesn't start with humans. It graduates up to humans from using them first with animals. So there's a multi-stage process that it needs to go through. And that's a really important safety aspect of doing this. So only once those high bars have been reached in terms of the safety and efficacy, does it progress to humans.
Fascinating. And so with that being said, that part of the trial is really just about, like, is it going to work in the sense of, can we, you know, put the stem cells in the eye and make all of the technical pieces work, not necessarily, you know, how much is it going to change vision, or is there a way to measure that?
Yes. So first and foremost, the safety element always comes first. And that's certainly the same even with human trials. But there are ways to also be able to measure, depending on the animal and how easy it is to measure certain responses, their response to light or to other things. So there can be ways to be able to gather a response and to know that it's working. So you definitely in the early phases also want to know that there is a positive effect. Otherwise, there's no there, even if it's safe, of course. So I think to answer your question, yes, it needs to be both about safety, and it needs to also prove that there is benefit there in terms of restoring vision.
And can you talk a little bit about, you know, how are they able to measure in an animal? Like, just get an example.
That's a great question, and I wish I knew the exact answer to that one in terms of how they use this with animals. I don't know, unfortunately, how they were able to test whether it was successful or not. Usually it's in the form of some reaction to a stimulus. So whether that would be light or some kind of images that would typically make an animal move or do something in a certain way, that's usually how it's kind of done in other circumstances or in other trials, other than ones that are completely about, you know, looking inside and seeing whether things are growing. So there's that potential. And of course, the more scientific method of actually then doing an autopsy and things like that to check how did it actually grow? How did the stem cells really respond and connect?
So interesting. I'm picturing like a, you know, sheep, like did the sheep run into the wall or not?
And typically we use kind of smaller animal models like mice, but yes, there could be a sheep too.
Hey, could be.
We do have another hand.
All right.
I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. Shana?
You did it.
Yes, you did pronounce my name correctly. You get a gold star.
Yay!
Yeah.
Thanks.
partially answered my question, but I was wondering about how, like, would you try and find a blind animal, or how? I mean, so you judge how they respond to light, how quickly they respond, or slowly, or how would that work?
Correct. Yeah. So I think to your first question about finding animals that are blind, there are very precise breeding programs for a lot of these research programs to make sure that they are working with animals that actually fit the needs of the research program or the treatment. So that would probably be one thing, that they would be bred to have the condition or be in a position to have a similar condition that can then be studied. The second question about the light, again, unfortunately, I did not ask Mark how they actually assessed the reaction to a stimulus that would then give you an indication of, okay, they can see this now, or they're responding to it. So I don't know, but I'm definitely going to ask him after this, and maybe I can send Sarah or Rob or Jeff an email to let them know how it was done, and they can tell you.
Thank you.
All right, and Christy is next.
So I have and thank you for this presentation. It's very interesting. I have a client who has macular degeneration, but she said something about atrophy. I'm wondering if you know what about that. And if somebody has an atrophy, she said it's like a small percentage of people with AMD that have the atrophy. So would this be something she might pursue?
Yes. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, I don't know her specific situation, but essentially, you know, atrophy is the wasting away of the tissue. And so that's really what's happening with those cells. The cells that we're trying to regenerate and replace is that they are degenerating, and so essentially atrophying. So yes, this is a therapy to be able to address that atrophy, to replace those cells, to be able to repair them, and to have the retina function again.
And so if somebody wanted to get more information, how might they get more information in terms of, like, maybe she could be a client or a test, or
sure,
actually so get the treatment?
I'm very happy for people, if they would like to know more or to become involved in some way, to email me, and I can work with Dr. Humine and his team on whatever either information or connection is needed. So what's the best way, Sarah? Is it for me to have my email address shared with people after this, or what would you suggest?
Yeah, I can go ahead and share out your information afterwards.
That would be great.
Yeah, I think that'll be really good. I'll share that out into the universe, and that way we can share the good news with people and see what we can do.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, no, we're very happy to share the work that's going on. So absolutely, Christy, if your friend wants to know more, be happy to share.
Thank you.
All right, we don't have any further hands now.
But now we do.
Look at it. You said the magic words.
All right. Vivian, go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to know, do you address the Charles Bonnet syndrome at all in your study or clients that you're working with?
So Mark works across lots of different areas of blindness. So I think he may have some work that goes on in that space, but I have not personally worked closely with him on that. It would be something that I could check with him. His team is really across a number of different areas. And so I'd be very surprised if there isn't somebody who is focusing in on Charles Bonnet syndrome.
I work at the Vista Center, and I see newly blind clients, and At least half of them in all three support groups that I lead have a macular degeneration, and many of them describe having the Charles Bonnet syndrome, which is hallucinations. So the reason that's important, I mention it here for everybody, is that people will say people are visiting them, that they see different types of fences and obstacles and people and that type of thing. So sometimes, especially the elderly, will talk about someone's visiting them, and actually that's what they're experiencing. And I just wanted to mention it to everybody that's listening, that that's not an off-the-wall comment per se, because of the side effect of having this particular eye problem. So, all right. Well, thank you.
Thank you for raising that. Yeah.
Sure.
All right. And then we have, one moment. We have Brandon. And you should be able to unmute, Brandon. Go ahead.
Yes. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
We can.
Yes, Brandon.
Perfect. So I do apologize. I've been in and out of work and being able to closely pay attention, and whether how my ability to pay attention is varying on my workload currently. But sure. I'm actually probably assuming that Sarah was expecting me to speak up at some point during this presentation. So I myself am actually a part of a clinical trial that is being put on through Mira GTX for retinitis pigmentosa for X-linked RP. With any of the stem cell research, do you think that there might be any potential translation? Obviously, AMD is different than RP. Both have kind of some similar effects and some different effects, obviously. But with any of the progress, I guess, with stem cells, the stem cell research, do you think that there could be any crossover, essentially?
I think when we have studies like this, we learn a tremendous amount. And we're always looking at how can we use what we learn, how can that be replicated and shared in other diseases. So I would really want to check with Mark before I said yes. I think this is definitely something that would translate across. But there's always that potential when you go to this level of doing a clinical trial, that you learn so much more about what is possible and how it can link to other areas. So I'm sorry, I don't know that I can specifically answer your question and say yes or no. But again, that's something I'm happy to follow up on and see if I can get back to you, Brandon, on if there is some promising signs in terms of how stem cells can be used there.
Perfect. And then one follow-up question. I'm trying to remember his name, because the doctor who developed the therapy that I went through, I believe his name was Dr. Michael Michaelides, Michaelides, something of that sort. Which my previous understanding recently, which mind you, I'm still in the study. I'm in the long-term session now. But previously I had learned that he actually has been working on something that could reverse RP rather than just stop it. 'Cause my personal case, my progression of vision loss with RP has stopped. Would maybe some type of a collaboration be possible? If that is the case, I guess. I know my understanding is also that this doctor is also out of the UK, which I know UK, US, entirely different approval processes and
Quite different systems, yeah.
entirely different, which is why the study here in the US that I'm a part of is actually co-sponsored by, I believe, Johnson and Johnson and Mira GTX.
Right.
So it's a whole like process, but I don't know if that was a possibility, and I wanted to just ask if that
Yeah.
would be a possibility, because
Yeah,
yeah.
collaboration is always a good thing. I think in terms of just the sharing of knowledge and opportunities to work together on things. Usually, there's quite a significant amount of IP protection in terms of what people can share and will share.
Absolutely.
That's usually not driven by the academics; it's more by the pharmaceutical
Yeah.
commercial entities.
Which I know my personal information for this study, I did actually sign something that where all of my information can be used on multiple other studies without like any identifiers.
Right. Yeah, the
So I
identifier.
know that's starting to be more of a common occurrence with studies, allowing just the data to be able to be accessed by other studies, as
Yeah.
long as it's relevant.
And that's incredibly important. I mean, it's great that that's the way it's being used, right? Because that means that people who are trying different things get to use the data to see if this would be, if they can model whether this would be an appropriate therapy or way to go. And so it's great that you've done that and that people can benefit from it. But yeah, in terms of the collaboration, I mean, Mark is particularly collaborative, particularly again across different areas, even different disciplines, but also at different institutes. So again, that would be something that I would be happy to talk to him about, and whether he already knows this person, that's possible as well.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I also appreciate you taking some time to answer that question for me too, and just the dialogue back and forth.
My pleasure.
But yeah,
Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Brandon. All right, we have time for one more question, Desi.
Well, right now we don't have a hand, but you know, as soon as I say that, we probably will.
Right. Dun,
Well,
dun, dun.
maybe not.
Well,
Maybe
that's a
not.
great question. So,
Yep, here's one. Nicolette, you should be able to unmute.
yes. Well, actually, I was going to wait and call Vivian later and ask her the question, but if you have time, when she was mentioning macular degeneration and people coming and visiting, one of the ladies at the Lighthouse years ago, she was in her, she was almost 90. And she was always complaining that people were coming into her apartment and moving things around. And at that time, this was like 25 years ago, and I wasn't that familiar with macular degeneration, although my mother had it in the early stages. But is that sort of the thing that you were talking about with elderly folks with macular degeneration, or was it some other, you know, they were, what did you mean, Vivian?
Vivian's back on mute. But I'm sure she'd love to connect with you on that, because it is pretty fascinating. I think that it's all dependent on different people from my understanding. You know, where there could be, you know, they see people, or they see, you know, things in their way, or all of a sudden, like, there's a tree, things like that. And so it's a very fascinating thing, but I'm sure Vivian would love to connect with you offline on about that.
And I will do that. I will do that. But it was interesting too, because she thought people were moving furniture around. So it is fascinating. Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful,
And
wonderful presentation.
hey, the walls move in my house all the time. I'm telling you, I find them and I go, wait, where you weren't there before? Joel, I'm totally blind, just so you know. So yeah, he moved a little too fast and all of a sudden, whoa, oops. All right. Well, thank you so very, very much. And thank you for being willing to follow up with us as well. I think that that's such an important piece, is that follow up, because people, you know, we leave and we have more questions. So thank you so much for hanging out with us today and bringing this good work to us.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to meet with you all and to share what we're doing. And no, very happy to follow up and connect on any specific questions that anyone has.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you, Joel.